guys, welcome back to the Double Coverage Sports Podcast with Johnny and Andrew Cassis. I'm Johnny.
I'm Andrew.
And we just want to thank everybody for tuning in to episode 4 with us today. And for everybody who's listened to episodes 1 through 3 and who's followed us on any of our social media pages, we just want to thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing, liking. It means so much to us. We really appreciate it, guys. We couldn't do this without you, so thank you so much. Andrew, you want to give them all the socials?
Yeah, if you guys haven't had a chance to yet, on Twitter, our Twitter handle is at Double Coverage K, Double Coverage Sports Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, as well as SoundCloud and Anchor. So, like Johnny said, thank you again for everyone who tuned in and who continues to tune in.
So, before we get into our big topics on the show today, guys, we have a bigger issue at hand here at the Cassis household. And it has
to big one.
It has to do with one of my family's favorite things, which is coffee.
Drink a lot of it, yeah.
Now, I couldn't help but watch my mom and my brother today put their coffee while I sat idly by, and I see them doing it absolutely wrong. Completely wrong. The absolute wrong procedures to put coffee. I put the cream and sugar first, then add the coffee. These maniacs over here decide it's a good idea to put the scorching hot coffee first, then the condiments. Andrew, would you like to explain yourself?
It's a really big deal here, pal. It's not that big of a deal. It's just it melts into the cup of coffee and you stir it. If you stir it fast, it's going to make a mess, which I think is like your big concern about mess making.
No, it's not a concern. It's what happens.
No, it doesn't happen because I put my cup of coffee and I didn't make a mess on the counter.
Well,
because
I
let the cream and sugar melt into the hot cup of coffee like a normal person.
Okay, well then, you don't even account for the fact that you have to put less coffee. Because when you put when you put the cream and sugar in, if you put too much coffee, it's going to overfill
not
and go over the top.
Not if you let the freaking cream and sugar melt first before you start stirring the coffee. If you just let it melt in, it'll dissolve away. Mom, can you back me up on this, please? We brought in Mom for this one because my mom are on the same page about putting the coffee first. Mom, what do you think?
Hey guys, I do the coffee first and the cream and sugar. I don't know. It's just the way I've done it my whole life, and that's it, and it tastes good. So.
Well, Mom, just because you've done something your whole life doesn't mean it's the right way. I'm here trying to teach you guys.
Why should you teach me? I'm your mom.
Why are we learning from you anyway about the cup of coffee? Okay, and that's like saying like you should put the milk before cereal, because cereal would be the base of your bowl. So that would be the coffee of your cup, right?
Well, no, if you're
and
using
then you put the milk set. You don't put the milk first in your cereal, do you?
No, but a bowl is a little bit bigger than a cup
of
coffee.
Would.
No, a bowl, you're putting it into a bowl. The chances of it spilling out of a bowl are less likely than the chances of coffee spilling out of a mug.
It depends on the person pouring it. If you had a heavy hand like you, Johnny, you're going to go ahead and spill the coffee all over the place. Andrew and I do it very precisely. Do not make a mess, and it tastes very good when we're done.
Exactly. Well said, Mom.
Well, you guys don't think it makes a mess. I think it makes a mess. I'm going to take pictures to document the proof. So I'm convinced that the way to do it is my way. So here's what we're going to do. After the podcast is released today, we're going to go on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and we're going to put up a poll that gives a simple question. When you put coffee, what comes first, cream or sugar or the coffee? And everybody who's listening to this, please go and vote so that way I can prove my parents and my whole family that they're wrong.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that. I mean, us normal people really know how to drink and put a cup of coffee. But nevertheless, thanks, Mom, for joining in on the show today. Hope to have you back in soon. Thanks for being our first, like, celebrity, I guess, appearance.
Love you, Mom.
You're welcome, guys. Have a good day.
Love you,
Mom.
And cream first, sugar, then coffee. Bye.
Oh, gosh. Now that the big topic's out of the way, guys, we can head into the breaking news from the NFL this weekend. Antonio Brown, former wide receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers, was traded to the Oakland Raiders. So we're going to be getting into that. Going to be talking a little Kansas City Chiefs football. Justin Houston was released, so another big name pass rusher will be on the market after his release from Kansas City. Then we're going to get into the dumpster fire that is the Los Angeles Lakers season.
Oh, poor Lakers.
So far, it's pretty much over, so we're just going to give you a little bit about what happened, give you some updates on the injuries to some of the key young guys, and give you a little update on LeBron. Then we're going to move into our top 10 NBA players. We're going to give you our top NBA players from this season, looking at their body of work and what they've done for their team this season, not over the course of their career, because as we know, LeBron would probably be number one, not probably.
You
got
to slip him
one.
In somehow, don't you, Johnny?
Yeah, I mean,
you have to mention that LeBron's the greatest in the world every show.
Basically.
Yeah. So, leading off, guys, Antonio Brown, like Johnny said, was traded from the Pittsburgh Steelers to the Oakland Raiders in what I believe to be an absolute coup for the Oakland Raiders. Yeah. They only gave up a third and a fifth round pick in this upcoming draft for the all-pro wide receiver. I mean, the guy's a maniac, and they came away with a steal to grab him. I just can't believe he actually went to Oakland.
Yeah, pick number 66 in the third, pick number 141 in the fifth. The Raiders last year traded a third-round pick alone for Martavius Bryant. So you throw a fifth-round pick in there and you get a guy like Antonio Brown. This Raiders organization should be feeling real confident about the move that they made over the weekend. When Antonio Brown was actually traded, he agreed right away, which is kind of what we thought was going to happen, that he would re-sign and restructure probably an extension with whatever team he did get traded to. Well, the Raiders made it happen with a new 3-year extension for him on top of his contract worth $54.1 million total, $30 million guaranteed. It adds up to about $18 million a year, a little more than $18 million a year. It puts him just above Odell Beckham as the highest paid receiver in football, which, I mean, I'm sure is something that they were looking for. So that's good on Antonio Brown's side.
And one thing that kind of gets lost in the shuffle with this whole trade dilemma surrounding Antonio Brown, you know, aside from the organization and him not getting along and the problems with him, Big Ben, and Le'Veon, Antonio Brown, for being the all-pro receiver that he is and how prolific that he's been over the last couple seasons, had no guaranteed money from the organization over the next 3 years in his contract. So definitely made sense that way for why he wanted to find a new home and get that new money and get more guaranteed.
But, well, that's been the Steelers' MO, though, Andrew. I mean, looking back at what they do and how they conduct their business with free agents and re-signing their own players, the Steelers don't really give a whole lot of guaranteed money in the first place. They really only guarantee the first year, and a lot of times what they do is they structure the contract so where most of that first year's salary is just in like a signing bonus or a team roster spot or something like that, where that guarantee is only for that year, when most teams usually guarantee the first 2 years of a player's contract. So that's something interesting to keep an eye out for.
I mean, Antonio Brown should be an exception to that, right? Like,
you would think.
I mean, he's all pro. No, like, it's been like 5 years running now. Yeah. 6 years in a row, over 100 catches. You got to pay the guy. You got to give him some incentive to stay, especially when you have all this turmoil going on in the organization behind closed doors.
Well, Antonio Brown almost kind of did himself in by being so good so young. He was amazing that second year out of college when he was undrafted. Or was he undrafted or a 6th-round pick?
He was really late, yeah.
I can't remember. But he came out that second year, had almost 1,500 receiving yards, 80-something catches, and absolutely balled, earned a contract. But the contract now is looking, you know, dismal in terms of size compared to what other people are getting on the market, which is why I'm assuming he tried to get his way out of Pittsburgh. The trade of Antonio Brown is huge. I mean, whenever you trade one of the top 3 wide receivers in the league, it's going to be a big story. But this really isn't big news in terms of the John Gruden era in Oakland. Since last year, he's been a part of some major trades that have sent some major pieces and gotten some major pieces in return, right, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, they've gotten great compensation when you kind of really take a step back and look at it. People were kind of hating on them, I guess you could say, for dealing Khalil Mack and then mid-season getting rid of Amari Cooper. They sent away a 3rd and a 5th round pick in this year's draft, a 2nd and a 5th in next year's draft, along with those 2 players. But in return, they got Antonio Brown, and then they also have piled up 3 first-round picks, 2 more coming in this draft and 1 more in next year's, also a 2023rd round and a 2019 6th round. So not looking as bad as the eye test might tell you with Oakland dealing all these big-name guys out. They may be set up for the future, but, you know, that time will tell what goes on there.
Yeah, I think of the 3 trades, Oakland probably won 2 of them. Amari Cooper and the way he's playing, he's going to demand a lot of money, you know, probably about where Antonio Brown is sitting right now. So getting a first-round pick for him was nice, considering his history of dropping balls and stuff. I understand for Cowboys fans, he did a lot for Dak. They were 7-2 after they got him. So I don't think it was a bad trade on Dallas's end, especially looking at the free agent market this year in terms of wide receiver, looking at the draft in terms of wide receiver. Definitely don't mind the trade that the Cowboys made, but love the fact you're able to get a first-round pick if you're Oakland for him. The trade for Khalil Mack is a different story, though. The Raiders are crazy. I don't care if you get 2. I don't care if you get 3 draft picks from that team. Khalil Mack is the 2nd best defensive player in football, and it's not even close after that. My 2 are Aaron Donald, Khalil Mack, and who cares? Because those 2 are just that dynamic. They do that much for your defense. and getting two draft picks as compensation, you're not going to get another Khalil Mack. The draft pick from the Bears is going to be in the high 20s now because they made a deep playoff run. So when you get guys early in the draft like Khalil Mack, you know, somebody who's that big of a force, that's a guy you usually want to pay. And even if you don't want to pay, that's somebody who deserves to be paid and will get paid by somebody.
I know dealing a player of his caliber is not exactly a popular decision, but I guess you can I can kind of see why Oakland was doing it. You have the Chiefs and the Chargers in your division, who probably the most two explosive offenses in the NFL last year.
The Rams, too.
Yeah, the Rams, you would include them, but you have to keep up with them. So it kind of makes sense to go get these draft picks so you can stockpile as much talent in a very deep defensive draft in this upcoming year. And then you add a guy like Antonio Brown to match with Derek Carr, who is, you know, he's pretty serviceable. He had a really good year. Hopefully, they're hoping he can get back to his MVP caliber season. And if he can, then they're going to try and keep pace offensively and just worry about defense later. That's really what I think they're going to do.
I see what you're saying, but the Raiders didn't know that Antonio Brown was going to come available. So, and this is a deep draft, especially in terms of defensive linemen. But when you look at somebody who does as much as Khalil Mack does on the field, just two first-round picks isn't enough for me.
Yeah, I think they were just trying to create as much space as possible. But, I mean, it's hard to justify trading away Khalil Mack. For Antonio Brown, it makes a lot of sense, too, to go to the West Coast. He was rumored initially when the trade talks surfaced about him moving on from Pittsburgh that San Francisco was the ideal landing spot for him. Then later, late last week, about Friday, we got word that he was going to Buffalo, of all places. So opposite side of the country, not really going to work well for him wanting to build his brand. So definitely good for Antonio Brown for himself being able to get to California to further expand his brand. He's already been on national TV shows like Dancing with the Stars. He was even on The Masked Singer. He was the Hippo, I think he was. So he's just trying to further expand his brand, and a move to Las Vegas and a potential chance to be the face of the franchise for the Raiders is pretty enticing for him, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Just a little bit more about the Antonio Brown move that was really surprising is going to be the fact that he's actually going to cost more against the cap for the Steelers than he will for the Raiders, who just gave him a new contract. So for the Steelers, and this is per Adam Schefter, they're going to have $21 million of dead cap this season just from Antonio Brown, which is thought to be the biggest one-year salary cap charge in NFL history for a player not on the current roster. So that's just amazing. $20 million for somebody who's not even going to play football on your team. It just shows the kind of disconnect and the type of stuff that was going on in that Steelers organization that they were willing to ship him off and take that big hit. Staying in the AFC West, moving on to the Kansas City Chiefs, who made a big move this weekend, moving on from one of their highest paid players, Justin Houston, who they had signed to a 6-year, $101 million deal, was released to save $14 million against the cap. Unlike the Steelers, this is a great move for the Chiefs. They're going to be left with about $5 million in dead money, but that's nothing compared to the $14 million they're going to save in cap relief by releasing him. The biggest year Jay Hughes had with us was in 2014, where he had 22 sacks, which was only a half a sack away from a single-season sack record set by Michael Strahan.
Letting go of a guy like Justin Houston for Chiefs fans kind of hits a little close to home, especially for people like us. He's very impactful for us over the last 8 years he's been in the NFL. Coming out of Georgia, he was a staple along with Tamba Hali, leading the defense, and then eventually formed into the mainstay on our linebacking core. Chief General Manager Brett Veach had this to say about him: Justin has made a lasting impact on this franchise, and I can't thank him enough for his contributions over the years. These decisions are never easy. I have a great deal of respect for Justin as a player and person, and I wish him the best for him and his family moving forward. So just kind of shows you the impact he also had on the front office. He's very well respected throughout the organization. Tough to see him go, but you kind of move on and you ask why now. The move kind of makes sense because his production, and as we mentioned last week on the show, he hasn't had over double-digit sacks since that 22-sack season and has still yet to play a full season since then. He still is only 30 years old, so while his best days might be behind him, he's still an effective pass rusher and will be highly sought on the market come free agency. The scheme change and the hiring of Steve Spagnuolo kind of plays into this decision, and Johnny was going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so the release is big in terms of what it means for the grand scheme of the Chiefs' defense. It's really a changing of the guard, going from Bob Sutton's scheme and Bob Sutton's defense to Spagnuolo now taking over and implementing his scheme. I think Nick Jacobs said it best. He's a content creator for 41 Action News and is a contributor to the 4th and 1 podcast. You can find him at Jacobs71 on Twitter. He had a thread about the Chiefs defense, and I think he really hit it on the head. Bob Sutton's 3-4 scheme required a lot of pieces meshing perfectly in order to be effective. Players had to win their one-on-ones, whether that be outside pressed in man coverage for corners and DBs or on the edge rushing the passer. Players had to win their battles, and you needed players who were good enough in their own skill set to win those battles. Nick even emphasized how in 2015 the Kansas City defense was super effective with studs all over the place. And this again just goes into why that scheme was effective for Bob Sutton with these players. Justin Houston in his prime. Marcus Peters came out and led the league in interceptions as a rookie. Derek Johnson was playing really well as an inside linebacker, one of the best in the league. Eric Berry was in his prime before all the injuries. So this defense had players all over. Bob Sutton was awful at adjusting. That was probably our weak point for our defense going throughout the Bob Sutton era, is that we were really bad at adjusting. And over time, players started to age. Derek Johnson got older, was eventually released. Justin Houston hasn't been himself, has missed a lot of time. Eric Berry was a huge factor who we know has missed a lot of time with his injuries, like, you know, his cancer scare, and, you know, we hope he's doing well, but he missed a lot of time. Tambaha Lee was playing really well alongside Justin Houston. He got older. We had to release him. So this left the Chiefs with subpar defensive players and using rotational guys and asking them to fill big voids in this defense. But now we have Steve Spagnuolo, who's going to come in here. He's going to implement his 4-3 scheme that he's been running for the better part of a decade with the New York Giants. And unfortunately, the pieces that we currently have don't fit. A lot of the pieces that we drafted this last year with Brett Veach do lean to more of guys with a skill set who fit a 4-3, which is even more interesting to maybe, you know, foreshadow on the fact that they were thinking about a move from Bob Sutton, considering who they drafted. But he's going to come in. He's going to look for guys, not just the starters. He's going to look to pay guys who are rotational guys who are going to come in, who are going to eat up some starter snaps and are going to be able to get the job done effectively. As we saw last year, we're going to outscore most teams we play. So just making sure that we have a defense that's competent, that's even just middle of the road, is going to be enough for Spagnuolo to really show that he knows what he's doing and is going to help the Chiefs win those ball games that against the Rams, against the Patriots, against those types of teams where it just seems like we can't get that final stop to really put the game away.
As you mentioned before, guys, Justin Houston now with his release is going to be one of the most coveted pass rushing targets for a lot of teams this offseason. Places I could possibly see him going to: Atlanta looks like a good spot for them. Indianapolis has a lot of cap space they can work with. They might try to make a run at him to add to their young defense and pair with Darius Leonard. And then another team that people don't really like to hear a lot about, the Patriots. And I don't like hearing about it because we just lost to them.
Yeah, for real.
He would fit nicely over there, especially with the news that Trey Flowers is apparently moving on to Detroit. Word around the league, too, is that he has a really good relationship with their pass rushing coach, Joe Kim. So that could play into a lot as to why he maybe makes a move and a jump to New England. Johnny, do you have any other places you might think he end up?
Yeah, I think the Niners are an ideal spot for him. About $65 million in cap space. They also have the number 2 overall pick. The Niners are in a prime spot to draft a defensive standout with that pick, like probably Nick Bosa. You know, you can add Nick Bosa to that starting defensive line of DeForest Buckner, Solomon Thomas, and then you throw Justin Houston in there, and all of a sudden that line, that defensive front is looking pretty scary. The Niners do have a lot of holes they need to address, though. They have Jimmy Garoppolo, the franchise quarterback, but they do need to get some offensive linemen to help protect him. He did get hurt last year, so injury concerns there. Got to make sure you protect the guy that you're paying that much money to. And also some playmakers. Last year, their best playmaker was Matt Breida and Pierre Garçon. So if we can really work to get some, a couple of guys like that, I think that'll be a priority for the Niners headed into the offseason.
Speaking of offseasons and continuing with our most recent dismal Laker talk, the Lakers, who look to be completely out of the playoffs now, are going to be looking ahead to their offseason and what kind of moves that they're going to make to hopefully propel them into the playoff picture going into next year. Over the weekend, game against the Celtics, the Lakers lose their 5th game in a row, dropping to 30-36 on the season. During the game, Kyrie Irving dropped 30 points in the Celtics' 120-107 victory over his former teammate LeBron. After the game, Kyrie said, "I feel for him," when asked about the current state of the of LeBron's Lakers. Went on to say, "LeBron has always been a championship contender. Not to qualify for the playoffs is hard. I can only imagine what he's going through." So,
well, you don't have to imagine. You didn't make the playoffs until you got LeBron.
Yeah, exactly. So he kind of knows the feeling. He was the lone guy in Cleveland up until LeBron came and helped him. So he knows exactly what he's going through. LeBron didn't play too much with the minute restriction they have him on. We'll get into that a little bit later. But in 25 minutes, was still able to record a triple-double. Piled up 30 points, 12 assists, and 10 rebounds. And, I mean, the Lakers as a whole, we watched the whole game. They didn't play awful. They actually played a decent game, considering they had basically the entire South Bay Lakers starting roster in their lineup that day. They shot 48% from the field, and hallelujah, finally made some free throws. They only missed 4 of their 18 attempts, so that was nice to see at an 80% clip, finally. Wait,
that doesn't sound very good, but for the Lakers, that's astronomical.
Well, when you're shooting 55% a game, it's, you know, it's a nice jump. At least there's some sort of improvement, so we could hang our hats on that, guys. But, you know, we made our run late in the game, went on an 18-4 run in the middle of the third quarter, then came out sluggish in the fourth, couldn't stop Boston from getting a couple easy buckets, and they eventually pulled away.
Taking a look at the box score, you can't help but see the amazing contributions that our boy JaVale McGee, and in all honesty, it's probably my least favorite Laker in a long time, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. I don't know what it is about him. He doesn't fit in a Laker uniform. He's literally my least favorite Laker over the last couple years. They both played a combined 32 minutes, 16 and 16, and they had a plus minus of minus 32, guys. Oh, you guessed it.
Abysmal.
Yeah, so for every minute they were on the floor, they cost the Lakers 1 point. So if they played a full 48-minute game for the Lakers, they played all 48 minutes, the Lakers would have lost by 48. Now, I understand, like, stats aren't everything, but when you watch the game, you can just tell the energies that the young guys were able to play with compared to the vets.
Love to see it.
It's pretty obvious. You can tell the effort is there when the young guys are there. You see them diving for loose balls, going after offensive rebounds and second chance points. I know Andrew gets real jacked up seeing guys like Wagner and Caruso run around out there. They played pretty well over the last two games.
Yeah, I get pretty hyped when watching Mo Wagner and Jonathan Williams put up big games. And Mo Wagner actually got his first start in the NBA against Boston, and he didn't disappoint. He put up 22 points, had 6 boards and 3 assists, was running the pick and roll great, was active defensively. I love seeing the young guys. It's nice. It's a nice change of pace, especially when you have a lot of vets who don't seem like they really want to be a Laker. These young guys, to me, bring the energy, and they're excited to wear the Laker uniform. Another guy, like I said, Jonathan Williams stood out to me. Played very well. He recorded a double-double. He didn't start the game, but he finished with 18 points, 10 rebounds, and including like 3 or 4 ferocious dunks that we pointed out on our Twitter page if you guys were following along the game with us. Between him and LeBron, he got a lot of his easy buckets from the pick and roll. He was running it to perfection almost and got a lot of easy buckets right at the rim by way of a LeBron James assist. So they're going to keep seeing a lot of minutes, especially now with the news breaking that both Lonzo Ball and Brandon Ingram, who has blood clots in his shoulder, are going to be shut down for the remainder of the season. And Kyle Kuzma, who also missed the Boston Celtics games, remains his status kind of remains up in the air, although he's going to continue practicing and participating in team activities. So we'll see what happens moving forward. But like Johnny said, it's always great to see the young guys performing. I love it. We even had Caruso out there, bald head and all, making some plays. You know, I love to see it, and I get real jacked up about it. So glad that they got their time in.
With the Lakers in full offseason mode, Kevin Arnovitz wrote an article on ESPN that hits it right on the head. The Lakers do need to self-evaluate this offseason. Fortunately for them, the answer to the question they need to ask themselves is much better than the answer they would have given themselves in past seasons. The recent string of seasons have been bad for the Lakers. They've been awful. They've been literally the worst, and I mean the very worst. No team in the NBA has lost more games over the past 6 seasons than our very own Los Angeles Lakers. Over the recent off seasons, we go in asking the same question. Who will the Lakers land this offseason? What name free agent? And as every summer passes, the Lakers don't land the big fish. Hell, even DeMar DeRozan wouldn't meet with us. Instead, we opt to sign the likes of Timofey Mozgov and JaVale McGee. The question the Lakers should have been asking themselves is, how is our personnel attractive to top-tier free agents? The Lakers brand is strong, as Arnovitz even said in his piece. Even when the Lakers are miserable, the team still carries a golden mystique. National TV dates, A-list celebrities in attendance, the steadfast condition of just being the Lakers. And he is right. But this has been the case for the last 6 years. All these things have been in place before, and it's not like they've gone away. Staples has always been there. The jerseys hanging the rafters have been there. But what really makes this offseason different is when we ask the question, how is our personnel attractive to top-tier free agents? We can say that we have LeBron James. Now, I know the narrative is out there that many top-tier players don't want to play with LeBron James. Unfortunately, I just don't buy it. Everywhere he's gone, he's been able to attract free agents, whether that be signing them and enticing them to come to wherever he is, going wherever they are, or trading for players like he did with Kevin Love. He has found a way to get players around him and be effective when doing so. So I believe this offseason, having LeBron James, having Magic Johnson, having Rob Pelinka, the Lakers are going to be able to go out there and make a move that's going to help better this franchise and help the Lakers moving forward become championship contenders with LeBron James at the helm for the next few years at least.
And if this season is any indication as to what LeBron is going to be giving the Lakers the rest of the way throughout his contract, the future looks good. He's still balling out. He's still a top 10 player in the NBA. And speaking of top 10, you guys know, those of you who have been listening, how much here at Double Coverage we love giving you guys top 10 lists. Well, you're getting another one. Right now, Johnny and I are going to give you our top 10 NBA players so far this season. So stick around. It's coming up right now. Kicking off the power rankings, guys, number 10, Johnny and I both have on our list Nikola Jokic, the center from the Denver Nuggets. This season, averaging 20.4 points per game, 10.8 rebounds per game, and averaging 7.5 assists, all while shooting at 50% from the field.
Yeah, Jokic leads Denver in points, rebounds, steals, and assists. So, and the crazy thing is he was actually a second-round pick. He's been an amazing find to pair with Murray, Millsap, and Mason. You know I love alliterations. And the Nuggets are number two in the West right now and playing really good basketball. Number nine on my list is Joel Embiid, the center from the Philadelphia 76ers. This year he's averaging 27 points, 13.5 rebounds, and 3 assists. The 76ers are currently third in the East and have a great chance of hosting a home playoff series. Joel has been a monster. The only problem with him is keeping him healthy.
Number 9 on my list this season is Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard is leading the Trailblazers in scoring, averaging 26.1 points per game, 4.6 rebounds per game, and 6.5 assists. The four-time All-Star continues to carry the Blazers franchise, and along with Yusuf Nurkic, Lillard is transforming this team into what looks to be a real title contender. So much so that Charles Barkley even said that the Blazers are going to dethrone the Warriors in the West and reach the NBA Finals. Spoiler alert, Charles Barkley's wrong.
In my 8th spot, I have Damian Lillard. As Andrew just talked about, he's doing a really good job of leading the Portland Trailblazers. They're 7-3 in their last 10, and only a game separates them at the 5 and Houston at the 3 spot, so they could be looking to host a home playoff game if they get a nice late-season push here from Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum.
Joel Embiid comes in at the number 8 spot on my list this season. He missed 8 games prior to the game against the Pacers recently. After the game stated he wasn't 100%, as he nonchalantly put up 33-12, safe to say that he's back to his old self. Both he and the Sixers can hope that they can make his health an afterthought moving forward. Coming in at number 7 on both mine and Johnny's list this season, Kawhi Leonard. The Toronto forward has propelled this team to a number 2 seed in the Eastern Conference. Kawhi is averaging 27.1 points per game, 7.3 rebounds, and 3.3 assists. He has been an offensive force this season and is as good as ever defensively. Raptors are 10-1 when Kawhi takes more than 22 shots this season, so they can hope that he keeps his volume up.
Yeah, Kawhi's missed some games this year, though. It's kind of interesting the approach the Raptors are taking with him. They're being extremely cautious with his load management this season, as he often doesn't play back-to-backs. He's only played 48 games out of Toronto's 67 this season. Coming in at number 6 for both me and Andrew is probably my favorite player in the NBA right now, LeBron James. He's averaging 27 points, 8.5 rebounds, 8 assists. Look, LeBron is produced in LA. I understand maybe the record's not what the Lakers fans would want to see, but when he's on the floor, he's really putting up numbers. He's missed 18 games this season for the hamstring, but has proven he's still one of the top 10 players in this league.
Yeah, I'm not a giant fan of LeBron coming into the season. You guys could ask Johnny. He's kind of changed my mind a little bit. He's just completely balled out for the Lakers when he is on the court. And hopefully he can propel this franchise back into the glory days that we so missed dearly. Coming in at number 5 on my list, Kevin Durant. The Warriors forward has continued to put up amazing offensive numbers this season and has stepped up his defensive game, probably being a better defender against forwards than Draymond Green is right now. The Warriors coach Steve Kerr believes that Kevin Durant could be one of the best on-ball defenders in the NBA moving forward.
Number 5 for me is Steph Curry, who obviously is probably the greatest shooter in NBA history. Steph's missed 11 games this season, and the Warriors are 5-6 during those 11 games. And, I mean, there's just something about it. Is there anything more intimidating than watching Steph Curry yank it from 30 feet and then just do his stupid little shimmy in front of you?
No.
There's nothing more demoralizing than watching this little guy run around the court and just yank it. It's ridiculous.
I've got Steph at number 4 on my list, one spot ahead of Johnny. Steph is averaging 28 points per game, 5.3 rebounds, and 5 assists. And he's shooting just an unbelievable 43% from the three-point line. Greatest shooter of all time. He might be my favorite player to watch in the NBA. I love the shimmies. Johnny's not a fan of it, but he's the engine that continues to make this Warriors team go, and he will probably lead them back to the finals.
Number 4 on my list is actually Kevin Durant, the better player of the two. He's averaging 27 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists. In his last game, midway through the fourth quarter, he went down with an ankle contusion. Steve Kerr says he'll be fine, and he didn't return to the game, but he's only missed one game so far this season, so he's really been the Iron Man for that Golden State team.
Checking at number 3 on my list, James Harden. While his scoring streak may have stopped of scoring more than 30 points per game, he still hasn't let up in his offensive production, and here's an interesting stat. In the NBA this season, the top 5 players in isolation possessions, number 5 is Giannis, number 4 is Kevin Durant, number 3 is Russell Westbrook, and number 2 is DeRozan. None of them have over 300 isolation possessions. James Harden comes in at 1 with 1,015.
Coming in at number 3 for me is Paul George. While I believe he looks terrible in that Oklahoma City color, we're not going to talk about it. The Thunder sit at number 4 right now in the Western Conference, but need to be careful as they're only 3-7 in their last 10 games. Their defense has really been slipping. Paul George missed a couple of games, but if he can come back and be the elite defender he is and put up the career numbers on offense that he is, the Thunder are going to do really well the rest of the season and heading into the playoffs.
At number 2, just one spot ahead of Johnny's, he's averaging a career-high 28.5 points per game. He's averaging also 8 rebounds and 4 assists and shooting almost 40% from three-point land. Paul George has been the best on-ball defender in the NBA this season, so the Thunder can hope that he stays healthy for this playoff run they're about to make.
Coming in at number 2 for me is the most unstoppable force on the offensive end of the floor in the NBA, James Harden. He's averaged 36 points, 6.5 rebounds, 7.5 assists this year. The Rockets have won 8 straight, and Harden may have something to do with it.
And coming in at the top of our list, Giannis Antetokounmpo. The Milwaukee forward has led the Bucks team to the number 1 overall seed and the first team to 50 wins in the NBA this season. He's averaging 26 points per game, 12 boards, and dishing out 6 assists, shooting 58% from the field. And just to point out, he is slowly developing that three-point game, everybody, shooting at over 35% in his last couple games. So look out if he develops that and if he gets that going.
Yeah, I believe Coach Budenholzer has done a great job of unlocking Giannis' true potential. And I believe the cast around him on the floor has a lot to do with that. People like Brooke Lopez, Chris Middleton, Eric Bledsoe helped the Bucks spread the floor with shooting, and they are all good enough, besides Brooke Lopez probably, to take their guys one-on-one off the dribble. So it allows for a lot of drive and kick opportunities for Giannis and for those guys to get some open looks. You know, Bledsoe and Chris Middleton really shoot the ball well. So Giannis is number 1 and I think our MVP so far this year. So speaking of MVPs, we just wanted to give our mom a huge shout-out for coming on the show today. I know she was a little nervous, but she did awesome, and we love her. So hopefully you guys enjoyed having her on there for our little coffee segment.
Steal a line from Kevin Durant, you the real MVP.
But that's going to end up doing it for us today, guys, for the Double Coverage Podcast. Thank you so very much, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Again, please hit us up on our social media sites. Give us some feedback. Let us know what you think, what we can improve on, what you guys would like to hear out of the show. At the end of the day, we want to be talking about stuff that you guys are interested in and doing things that you guys like. So if you have any recommendations or considerations, please don't hesitate to hit us up on any of those sites.
Thanks, guys, again. Yeah, like Johnny said, for everything. again, if you need them, we're on Twitter at DoubleCoverageK. That's our Twitter handle. Everything else across the board is Double Coverage Sports Podcast, Facebook, Instagram, SoundCloud, and Anchor. We look forward to hearing from you guys, and thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.